Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, new questions about the role of the federal government in the debate about the future of the Colorado River.
And why many Canadian homeowners in the Valley are looking to sell.
But first, policymakers in Arizona have for a few years been trying to figure out the best way to make sure there's enough money to pay for road repairs here. Those costs have traditionally been covered by the gas tax. But as cars become more efficient and electric vehicles become more popular, that tax isn't bringing in as much money as it used to. A number of previous ideas have failed at the state capitol, but lawmakers will be taking up a new one later today. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Hey there.
So what is this new plan to try to deal with, or sort of, as some would say, sort of equalize what internal combustion engine drivers and EV drivers are paying?
Well, let me back up half a step. You talk about the failed efforts in the past. The idea is to find a way, as you say, to make folks who drive electric cars pay for their share of the roads that they're all driving on. One of the most popular ideas, and this goes back a decade, is what they would call a mileage tax. Mm-hmm. You know, if you drive a certain number of miles, you figure out what the gas equivalent would be, and you say, okay, we'll charge that. This has raised all sorts of alarms among some conservative members of the legislature. They say the government is tracking you. They're spying on you. They're surveilling you. That isn't necessarily the case, but it's basically killed the whole idea. So this new proposal would say, look, let's figure out what a typical car of this model would cost if you were using gasoline. So let's say you have a Toyota Corolla, and it would normally, you know, drive X number of thousand miles a year, you know, with, let's say, 15,000. Mm-hmm. And it would cost so much at gas at 18 cents a gallon, which it has been at since 1991.
Right.
And we'll come up with an equivalent of what that would be in electric miles. Now, this gets really convoluted in terms of setting the vehicle's kilowatt hour usage and the rest of it, but it is the best effort so far to figure out, okay, why should folks get a free ride for electric vehicles, particularly since electric vehicles actually are heavier than their standard models and probably do more road damage. This is always going to get a fight, but I think lawmakers are realizing, look, that 18 cents a gallon in 1991, the gasoline would have to be 42 cents a gallon now to just stay even with inflation. Or put it another way, that 18 cents is now worth 8 cents and everything else has gone up. So something has to give here. I don't know if this is the formula. I don't know if this is the year. But as more and more electric cars go on the road, as you point out, you've got to find a way of making everyone pay their fair share.
Right. Well, and Howie, I mean, to your point of, you know, something has to give, maybe not this, like what sort of the chatter at the Capitol? I mean, I would imagine that there would be some critics who are saying this is a new tax. We are not supportive of new taxes.
Well, they're not supportive of new taxes. And you'll love this because, as you know, there is a constitutional amendment to say if the legislature sets a new tax or raises an existing tax, you need a 2/3 vote. Well, you know how they're getting around that and trying to do it with a simple majority vote? They would let the director of ADOT set the levy, and therefore, well, we're not raising the tax. We're just telling ADOT, come up with a number and impose it when you do each year's vehicle registration fee.
Right.
Still not popular, but I think there's a sense of fairness that even folks who say, like, you know, Senator David Farnsworth, who is proposing this, say it's only fair. And he's certainly no fan of tax increases.
Yeah.
We say, why put the burden on everyone else?
All right. So that bill coming up later this afternoon in the Senate Finance Committee, in the House Health Committee this week, Howie, let's talk about a new food stamp verification requirement. What would lawmakers be looking to do here?
Well, they've already got a whole bunch of things that they expect applicants to do. Then there's some bills going through as far as work requirements or education requirements. This sets up maybe a little bureaucracy for the folks who are working at the Department of Economic Security to run other checks. For example, they'd have to go ahead and check lottery winnings. So they'd have to check with the lottery. They'd have to check with the tribal casinos or whatever reporting they're doing to making sure that the folks who are getting food stamps don't have income they're not reporting. Workers' compensation benefits. So they'd be checking with the Industrial Commission, check with the Department of Corrections to find out, are these people now incarcerated? And one of the more interesting ones, and I didn't know whether this was a problem, is the folks who get what we used to call food stamps, which used to actually consist of coupons, are now getting a debit card, which means they can be checked electronically where they use. And it would say that if folks are using them exclusively out of state for over 90 days, that suggests these are not Arizonans and we would be able to cut those off. So again, they're trying to find ways of saying, is there fraud in the system? Which is really interesting, of course, because remember, this is all paid for with federal dollars,
right?
But the legislature has decided, no, we need to get on top of that.
All right, Howie, lastly, before I let you go, I want to ask you about a bill that would put up a list of flags that would be allowed on public property. Presumably one that has your smiling face on it would still be allowed?
Well, I'd love to say that that's the case, but I'm not sure that you, in fact, you probably could not even put a KJZZ flag on the side of a public building. This is, the proponent, Nick Cupper, says, well, this is just to make sure that if you're putting a flag on public property, it's not just public buildings, but anywhere on public property, it should be a quote unquote neutral flag, a U.S. flag, a tribal flag, the flag of, fact is that Maricopa Community Colleges has a flag, you could put it on a public building. He says, we don't want divisive flags up. Now, he says, this could be about anything. Now, if you've been following the news, you've noticed that a certain governor has hung some gay pride and similar flags on the side of the Capitol. And there's not much they can do about it because she basically controls the executive tower, which is just west of the old Capitol. And I think the feeling is, well, if we can make a law, she will go ahead and say, well, of course I don't want to put a gay pride flag there or transgender rights flag or something else. But the curious thing about it is because of the way it's limited, it's a list of what is permitted. If you want to put up a flag, let's say the Suns are making a run for the championship, you couldn't hang a Suns banner on the side of the thing. And I think that's getting the attention of a few people of how restrictive do we want to be about this?
Sure. It's
one of those culture war things that comes up over and over. Fact is that because of the fact it's a bill, guess who gets to sign or veto it?
Right, the governor. All right, Howie, we'll have to leave it there. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Thank you as always, sir. Appreciate it.
Have a great morning.
Residents of cold weather places have made the valley their winter home for years. These so-called snowbirds tend to come from places like Minnesota, Illinois, or the Dakotas. There are also a lot of snowbirds from Canada. But as my next guest explains, that number is dropping a bit. Lori Lovine says part of that is due to the currency exchange. The Canadian dollar is weaker than the American one. And higher interest rates also play a role, he says. New reporting from the New York Times and others also says the U.S. will start requiring Canadian visitors to register with American immigration officials if they come here and stay for more than 30 days. But Lovine, a dual American-Canadian citizen and Valley realtor, says there's something else going on. He says working with Canadian buyers and sellers accounts for about three quarters of his business. I spoke with him earlier before the reporting on the registration requirement, and I asked if he's seeing Canadian homeowners in the Valley trying to get out of this market and sell their homes.
Well, yes. And, I have to say that I've been seeing that constantly throughout the 16 years. Canadians are coming and going. Their needs can change. Ones that have been down here a long time, they've done all the Arizona day trips, driven out to the coast, done everything that they wanted to do here. And maybe they're thinking that they'd like to do other things like travel in Europe or go to Dominican Republic or go to Hawaii. So we've always got Canadians coming and going, but there's a kind of a unique phenomena that's happening right now, coupled with the currency exchange. We're also getting Canadians that are offended, feeling bullied by the current administration with the threat of tariffs, and with the endless talking about sovereignty. Canadians don't want to be talked about as being the 51st state. They're proud of their country and they have no intentions on becoming part of America. Canadians and Americans have been best friends for generations, But in terms of, you know, of being annexed into the country, that's not something that's up for discussion.
So I'm curious about whether you see this as sort of a continuation or maybe a part of some of what we've seen in other contexts. For example, there was the Four Nations face-off hockey tournament where Canadians were booing the American national anthem. We've seen, you know, other kinds of, you know, people holding up signs, that's things like that. Do you see this as sort of all part of the same thing?
Yes, that is a direct result of the same thing. Yeah. Because the current administration is constantly referring to the Prime Minister of Canada as being the governor.
Yeah.
So people are finding that offensive. And it's just, you know, part of ongoing conversation, referring to Canada as the 51st state. You know, Canadians love Americans, but they're not too fond of the current administration right now. And I shouldn't say all of them, but definitely the overwhelming majority of them. So out of the 10 listings that I have right now with Canadians, 7 out of 10 of those are leaving for the reasons that we've just been discussing, you know, fatigue from the currency exchange. But the way that they're feeling bullied is the last straw that broke the camel's back. And I know I'm not alone as a realtor that specializes working with Canadians.
So I was going to ask you if you were seeing that the folks who are buying their homes here, if it was more of a sort of a financial, a practical issue with the currency exchange, or more of a sort of an emotional, philosophical concern with the current administration. It sounds like there's a combination of both. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's a very fair assessment. Yeah. So with the current, you know, political climate just being, you know, enough to say, okay, that's it, we're doing it, we're going to sell. And some of them are saying, well, we might come back, but for now, we're just, you know, not sure of what's going to happen. See, many of them are concerned that in addition to the threat of all these tariffs that are one day they're on, one day they're off, but in addition to that, they have fears that the current administration might want to place some kind of extra tax on them or their property, you know, being non-residents, non-citizens. So it's all three of those things.
Well, you led to my next question, which is, you know, whether you got the sense from talking to some of your clients that, you know, any of these folks might be willing to come back at some point, maybe if not as homeowners, as, you know, maybe, you know, several month at a time visitors at some point, either in a new administration or if this current administration stops talking about potential annexation and tariffs.
Actually, pretty much all of them are planning on coming back, other than the ones that have reached an age where health insurance is too expensive. So once you get up to that 75, 80 range, and that accounts for two of the three that I'm currently have listed that, you know, have different reasons for selling. But everyone that I've sold a house to here and that has cashed out, they all plan on coming back. They absolutely love Arizona. They love Americans. You know, Americans and Canadians have been best friends for, you know, many generations. And that leads me to make a couple more comments in this regard. A lot of our neighbors that know that we are also half Canadian have come over to us and apologized. And we're running into this all the time. We're actually currently in our motorhome in an RV park that's filled with Canadians and Americans from cold weather places like Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, Michigan, and elsewhere. And they're all coming over here apologizing to us, you know, for what's going on. They feel just awful. And they want us to know that it's not Americans that are feeling this way. It's just something that's going on in our political climate. And don't worry, it's going to, you know, it'll disappear. It's not going to be this way forever. And I've also heard reports, more than one actually, of Canadians dining out and restaurant owner or servers finding out that they're Canadians and not only apologizing, but comping their bill. Wouldn't take payment from them because I feel so bad for Canadians.
How are Canadians reconciling, as you reference, people coming up and apologizing or saying, hey, it's not us, it's just something political, when, you know, some of these same people probably voted for the person who is in power right now, who is making all these statements and policy decisions? Like, how do you kind of reconcile
all
that?
It's a little bit of both. People that identify as independents, Republicans, and Democrats are apologizing to us. They're feeling bad for Canadians because, you know, we hear it all the time. You Canadians are the friendliest people that we've ever met. And you're always saying sorry about something when there's nothing to be sorry about. And actually the properties that they put on the market, you know, they're selling, you know, fairly quickly if they're priced appropriately, because, you know, they're not living in them, you know, 12 months of the year. They're part-time homes, and, you know, and they're spending a lot of money locally to make their homes look attractive. And so, you know, it will have a little bit of a definite impact on our local economy if all the Canadians decide to cash out and leave, because they spend a lot of money here improving their properties and going out for entertainment and dining. And my bank account can attest to that too. When we first moved down here, we're spending lots.
Yeah. So how big of a topic of conversation is this among Canadians, both, I guess, here in the
Huge.
Valley and elsewhere,
Huge.
In terms of should we stay, should we go?
It's very commonplace. And actually, we've been trying to talk out some of our, you know, to convince some of our friends that have purchased down here that are thinking of selling. We're trying to talk them out of it. Canadians love Americans and they hope to be loved back. It's just they're you know, feeling threatened. And quite frankly, they're more than just concerned, they're scared. So please don't hold it against Canadians for them selling out, and know that most of them will be coming back to visit and just renting VRBOs. You know, to further enjoy this, you know, beautiful state that we're in and enjoy the people that live here, just like we did.
All right. Lori, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Lori Lovine is a real estate agent with Arizona Premier Realty Homes and Land.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what is the role of protesting in today's Trump era?
But first, as time ticks by without a resolution to the dispute between the seven states that share the shrinking Colorado River water supply, there has been a new twist in the ongoing debate. Back in February, the so-called lower basin states, California, Nevada, and Arizona, sent a letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum that some observers, fear could disrupt the already tense negotiations. Joining us now to break down the latest bend in the river, as it were, is KUNC reporter Alex Hager. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Sam. It's great to be here.
So tell us about this letter. What did it say and why was it significant?
Basically, the leaders of California, Arizona, and Nevada are trying to catch the attention of the Trump administration. A lot of the work formulating kind of the early groundwork for plans about how to manage the shrinking river in the future was laid by the Biden administration. And now this new White House has a chance to take the reins there. So they're basically saying, look, we think that the review the Biden administration did of our proposals wasn't enough. We want you to take another look at our suggestions for plans for how to share it. And, you know, this is a pretty tense negotiation between these states that share the river. And what I see this as is really just a step to not only get on the administration's radar, but maybe have a little bit of a first mover advantage. They are looking for any leg up they can get, and catching the attention of the administration and trying to draw attention to their particular proposed set of rules for how to manage water could be a way to get that leg up.
Now, is there any indication that the Trump administration is going to be receptive to this overture, or that they might be likely to agree with lower basin states in terms of what they're saying is necessary?
It is a little hard to tell. From everything I've heard so far, they did not issue a formal response. I would expect that the federal government, once it starts putting people in water management roles that are still waiting to be filled, will start meeting with state leaders. But from what I can tell so far, they have remained pretty agnostic.
Let's talk a little bit about what the lower basin states are saying is necessary. Broadly speaking, is it fair to say that the lower basin states are advocating for more severe cutbacks in terms of water usage regulations?
Right now, the lower basin states have proposed more cutbacks. There is a consensus among all of the states that use water from the Colorado River, from Wyoming down to California, that we need to use less. Climate change is putting less in the river every year, and we need to bring in our demand in accordance. And right now, the upper basin states are saying that they do not want to be the first ones to volunteer those cuts. The lower basin states, that includes us here in Arizona, they have volunteered some amount of water. Experts agree that more cutbacks are needed, but the lower basin states have taken the most significant step so far to promising reductions in water use.
Now, the other part of this letter concerned proposed upgrades at the Glen Canyon Dam. Tell us about that.
Well, Glen Canyon Dam, that is the one that holds back Lake Powell, so the big concrete monolith up in Page that was built largely in the 60s. And right now, there are fears that it is not infrastructurally ready to handle how small Lake Powell might get in the future because of that imbalance between climate change, shrinking supply, and the states that use the river reluctant to cut back on demand. Water levels in Lake Powell have got to record lows, and it's the nation's second largest reservoir, so it's a pretty dramatic drop. And the spot that the water is on the back of the dam, if it gets much lower, it could go below the intake pipes that carry water from the reservoir to the Colorado River on the other side, the section of the Colorado River that runs through the Grand Canyon. And so there are fears that if it keeps dropping, it would be not only impossible to generate hydropower inside the dam, but it might be really difficult to send water from one side to the other. So the only way to send water if water goes lower is through this little used set of backup pipes that everyone agrees should really only be used kind of as a emergency contingency. And realistically, we need to make some big and expensive upgrades inside the dam to make sure that even if water levels get low, we can still have water flowing through the Colorado River, flowing through the Grand Canyon. And that's one of the things that California, Arizona, and Nevada said in this letter is not only should you take a look at our proposal, but no matter what happens, someone is going to have to improve this dam. It is owned and paid for by the federal government.
Ah, well, speaking of which, any conversation about the federal government and what is or is not going to be funded right now is obviously colored by the drastic funding cuts that are taking place. Does it seem like those are likely to play a role when it comes to the Colorado River?
It sure seems like it. Right now, a lot of funding for Colorado River programs was paused. A lot of that comes through the Inflation Reduction Act, which designated $4 billion for Colorado River work. A lot of that was under review and kind of waiting in the early days of the Trump administration. That is everything from projects to help clean up after wildfires to make sure all that ash and soot doesn't end up in the rivers. It is also payments for big farms out in far western Arizona and parts of Southern California that were taking federal payments in exchange for using less water. We have slowly started to see some of those trickle back to reality, but there are people out there who are waiting on tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases, I would bet millions of dollars that are currently kind of hanging in limbo due to the Trump administration and its pause on these early batches of funding. And we'll have to wait and see if all of those rematerialize. And if they don't, it could be very difficult for some places to plan how much water they're using in the future.
Alex, we have just about 30 seconds left, but I'm very curious to know, what have you heard from your sources about Secretary Burgum in particular in terms of how he's likely to think about water issues?
Overwhelmingly, although I know that there is a fair bit of skepticism about his leadership on drilling and on oil and other resources, from what I've heard in the water community, a lot of folks are pretty positive. I think that he apparently has a fairly good track record back when he was governor of North Dakota, working with water resources in that part of the country. And I think people are cautiously optimistic that he will take the Colorado River issue seriously. And we have already seen at least one appointment of a fairly well-liked technical expert.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Lots to keep an eye on, as always. Alex Hager is a reporter at KUNC. Alex, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Arizona Senator Mark Kelly and Elon Musk got into an online back and forth last week after Kelly posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, about his recent trip to Ukraine and pushing for the U.S. to continue its support of that country. Musk, who owns X, replied, calling Kelly a traitor. In a column for the Arizona Republic, editorial columnist Phil Boas said in writing that Musk did an enormous favor for the loyal opposition. Boas joins me to talk more about that, along with Elvia Diaz, the Republic's editorial page editor. And Phil, let me start with you. What got you thinking about how this back and forth might be a benefit to Senator Kelly?
Well, I think it gives him a chance to really stand up for the party and stand against some of the what the Trump administration calls shock and awe, but what is really creating enormous chaos around the world with our allies, both in Europe and in Canada, Australia, and what looks like a serious turn in foreign policy that really needs to be challenged and questioned and debated in this country. And Kelly, by going to Ukraine, has really managed to set himself up as one of the leading voices in the Democratic Party against what looks like a very haphazard foreign policy on the part of the Trump administration.
So, Phil, do you then see, you know, we've heard so much about Democrats kind of trying to figure out the best way to go forward now. Is foreign policy in your mind maybe one of those paths?
Well, foreign policy right now is a shambles. We have our European allies at the moment thinking that the Atlantic Alliance that carried us through World War II and through all the post-year wars or post-war years is burning right now, is coming to an end. And these are some big questions that need to be talked about and debated in the strongest sense. It looks like Trump is winging foreign policy, and he is making enemies out of friends and friends out of people that ought to be our enemies, like Vladimir Putin, who in fact is an authoritarian and a tyrant.
Elvia, let me put the same question to you. I mean, as Democrats have sort of been trying to figure out what's next for them and how to maybe win back some of the voters they lost in last year's election, do you see foreign policy as a viable path to do that?
Well, it is one of the viable paths for the Democrats to stand up to Donald Trump, but I don't think that is what is going to be resonating with the American people, especially with the Democrats and independents and everyone else in between who voted for, other than Donald Trump, the not MAGA people. So, and I think that's why we're talking about Mark Kelly, because he was able to stand up to Elon Musk and go into this back and forth, because I think the American people, or a good chunk of it, are incredibly exasperated with their inability or little recourse to do anything really to stop Donald Trump and foreign policy and dismantling the federal government and dismantling all the programs and agencies that have supported this country for decades and for generations. So I think, I mean, Kelly is the right person to talk about foreign policy, but it's here in the United States, it's national politics, it's local politics, it's what people are feeling right now, that the Democrats really need to stand up to Donald Trump, and they're lost. I mean, there's very little that they can do. So, I mean, if foreign policy is a way to do it, yeah, sure, welcome that.
Well, and Elvie, it's interesting because there have been polls that suggest that voters have a less positive view of, for example, Elon Musk than President Trump. So I wonder if this is maybe a way for Democrats to sort of by proxy go after the president by going after Elon Musk, and not necessarily just sort of the Doge, you know, firings and layoffs that he's doing, but also just some of the other comments and statements he's making.
Well, yes, you know, I mean, Musk calling Senator Kelly a traitor just by going to Ukraine, just how Phil described it, it's just insane. So people have a way of identifying that, and getting rid of the Teslas are one way to complain about Musk. I mean, and Kelly himself, you know, got rid of his Tesla. A few days ago, joining a growing movement of people just going after what, you know, clearly is the only thing that matters to Musk, which is money. And if you remember, that's why Donald Trump staged a huge infomercial in front of the White House to sell cars.
Phil, Mark Kelly's profile nationally has obviously been raised. You know, he was reportedly on a vice presidential shortlist for Kamala Harris last year. I wonder, what do you think this episode, and as Elvia mentioned, you know, he made a kind of a big deal about getting rid of his Tesla over the last few days. Like, what does all this do for Senator Kelly's profile and maybe stature, not just in Arizona, but around the country?
Well, judging from the mail that I'm getting, from my piece ran in USA Today, and I have gotten so much mail that is so pro Mark Kelly. I think the fact that he is a veteran, that he's an astronaut, that he has served his country and put his life on the line in combat, that even today in the Senate, he is pushing for America to steel itself, to improve its defense industrial capacity, to start building up and to become strong. I think that's that is what the Democrats need to project. This is somebody who loves America, loves this country, is widely admired in the way John McCain was admired because he had served. And Mark Kelly had every right to challenge Donald Trump's foreign policy here. I think the Republicans, and I think Musk was, they were responding to an old tradition that politics stops at the water's edge, meaning Americans should present a united front when it comes to international affairs. Mm-hmm. But the Trump White House has forfeited that in the way they've run foreign policy.
Elvia, do you see Senator Kelly as maybe a good voice for Democrats to follow in their attempts to sort of get back to where they want to be politically?
I think Democrats will follow anyone who's willing to stand up to Donald Trump right now, because they're so desperate. Anyone can feel it. So, but yes, I mean, he's a respected senator from Arizona, and absolutely, again, anyone that can stand up to Donald Trump is going to be welcome.
Phil, I wonder if in some ways, you know, we talk about the concept of, you know, sort of unforced errors in politics. I wonder if you see Elon Musk calling Mark Kelly a traitor as sort of an unforced error for the Trump administration, maybe for national Republicans.
That's a huge blunder. And I don't even know if the Trump White House is capable of, reining him in, but they need to. Because that was a huge mistake, and it's only emboldened the opposition, and it's given greater stature to Mark Kelly.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, and Phil Boas, editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. Elvia, Phil, thanks to you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Last week, following a tumultuous chapter in the relationship between Ukraine and the U.S., both countries announced their agreement to a framework for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine's ongoing war with Russia. When the Trump administration presented those terms to Russia, however, Vladimir Putin rejected the deal, demanding that any agreement include a set of conditions related to Ukraine's long-term status, including a guarantee that Ukraine would not be allowed to join NATO. Joining me now via Skype to discuss the international community's reaction to Russia's reaction, as well as the latest geopolitical developments around the globe, is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, tell us how Russia's comments on the proposed ceasefire have been received.
If you look at the response to those comments, there are plenty around today, not least from the European Union's foreign policy chief, who has said that conditions demanded by Russia show that Moscow doesn't really want peace. Her name is Kaya Kallas. Ahead of the EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels this morning, Ms. Kallas said the ceasefire terms being set by Russia included all of Moscow's ultimate war goals. So the point there being is that we're seeing very few concessions, if any, from the Russians. And therefore, there's still a really big gap there between what Ukraine wants, which is membership of NATO and security guarantees and so on, and what Russia wants, which is some kind of long-form situation that that defines Ukraine's status and Russia's status as well. So I think this week is going to be interesting because Mr. Trump will speak to Mr. Putin again. And don't forget that a few weeks ago he did so in a 90-minute telephone conversation, which was very contentious because that appeared to be a unilateral dealing between America and Russia, and it cut out Ukraine and Europe. I think this week would be really interesting to see what comes out of that call from Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin. Are we about to see a 30-day ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine? And will that then lead to something more in the longer term? An awful lot of people are commenting on that at the moment.
Well, and as we keep an eye on that, Rob, of course, Syria And the future of that country also hangs in the balance. And this coming week, there's an important donor conference, also in Brussels, aimed at drumming up support for Syria. Why is that so significant?
Yes, there is this important conference in Brussels. It actually happens every year, but interestingly, it doesn't normally invite anyone from the Syrian government, even though it's a donor conference for Syria. And that's because Europe, by and large, has had a very bad relationship with the former leaders in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, who, of course, fled that country at the end of last year. But now that there's a new leadership in Syria, Europe really wants to get behind this guy and see if he will fulfill some of the promises that he has made about having an inclusive society, respecting the rights of women, respecting political and ethnic factions in Syria, and so on. So they've invited his foreign minister to that meeting in Brussels, which is quite significant in its own right. Syria, of course, is real fulcrum in the Middle East. Stable Syria has kind of ripples across the Middle East. And of course, the last thing anyone wants at the moment is more instability, more volatility in the Middle East. So you can see a lot of these international actors are trying to do whatever they can to try and sort of stabilize Syria and allow the new leadership to do what they've said, which is to hold some free and fair elections in the longer term. But there are big problems. A couple of weeks ago, supporters of the new leadership went on the rampage in the west of Syria, in places like Latakia, which is home to the Alawite community. And it was the Alawite community from which the Assad regime came. That was their ethnic group. So you can see that those were probably revenge attacks. But what it really questions is the authority of the new government in Damascus. Can they control people in Syria, and in particular some of their old supporters who still have all kinds of kind of gripes and scores to settle? The big question is, will Syria be a calm state, a calming state in the Middle East, or will it return to violence and volatility, which would then affect other countries in the region? I should just say that Iran hangs over all of this because Iran had very strong relationships with Bashar al-Assad, also with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And those relationships with the new government in Syria, of course, nothing like as strong. So it'll be interesting to see kind of where Iran stacks up in all this as well.
Speaking of unrest, Rob, over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of people descended on the capital of Serbia. This was that country's largest ever protest. Just adding to the stack of things to keep an eye on here, what was that protest about and how will that feature in the week to come?
Well, this is an interesting one. So this happened in Novi Sad, which is Serbia's second city. And if you look at the photographs, you see, you know, tens of thousands of people out on the streets. An independent monitoring group says they reckon 325,000 people were out there. If that's true, that definitely is the largest ever protest in Serbia's history. Now, why did this happen? Well, before Christmas, back in November, there was the collapse of a railway infrastructure made of concrete and glass and so on. And this collapsed and killed 15 people. Now, what that really triggered was who was accountable for that? Who was responsible for that? And when students in particular went to the government saying, we want to see the paperwork, we want to see what was behind all of this, what led to this, only some of the paperwork was made available to the and put in the public domain. And the students said, no, we want to see all of it. We should be much more accountable. You should be much more accountable as a democratic government. And the government didn't really come forth. So these protests have started. They've got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now we've seen students joined by all kinds of people in Serbia who are angry with corruption in the high circles in that country, with kind of cost cutting, with corner cutting. You know, they don't like it. They want to see much more transparency in what is quite an autocratic kind of government in Serbia. So it's interesting. It just has a whiff of the Arab Spring about this, that the people are sort of turning on the government in that country. So it'll be very interesting to see where this one goes.
Well, a lot of tense dynamics to keep an eye on this week. The BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones keeping us in the loop as always. Rob, thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. as Democrats in Washington struggle to find a unified approach to the Trump administration's whirlwind of action in his first few months in office, protests have been sporadic and scattered, some directed at immigration, some against the firing of federal workers, some against Elon Musk. It's a far cry from what we saw in 2017 when Donald Trump first took the White House, when hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets in the Women's March and thousands of people gathered at airports around the country in opposition to his so-called Muslim ban. There's been criticism that these debates are not focused enough, that they're just what Trump supporters want the left to do. So what is the role of protesting in today's Trump era? Our next guest points to the past for guidance. Rashad Shabazz is an associate professor of geography and African-American studies at ASU, where he studies how race, gender, and cultural production are informed by geography. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about it.
So much of protest over the last, 20 years, really since the sort of rise of social media and the internet, has really been organized around the anti, meaning the A-N-T-I, the opposition. And in being, anti this or anti that, many of these protests aren't organized. They don't emerge out of movement building. They don't constitute themselves through active participation with a community. And as a result of that, a lot of these protests don't have much more to consider or offer other than opposition. Hmm. The whole point of the protest is to simply say no.
Yeah.
And no doesn't have a vision. No has no horizon. No is not strategic. It can also be productive. I don't want to say that there's no usefulness of it, but I think we're at this moment right now where I think we're seeing the limits of that kind of public engagement, that kind of protest. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm hoping this moment might move us toward is demonstrations. Demonstrations are based around organizing when it's not sexy, when there's no sort of crisis on hand, against the backdrop of an idea or a set of policy demands or principles that they want to see happen. And then in particular moments, those people bring those ideas to the public square, mm-hmm. and they begin to demonstrate to the public this vision for whatever it is. And what we're seeing right now, what we've been seeing a lot of, is no. Hmm. And that, it just has profound limits.
So that's very interesting, the difference there between protesting and demonstrating. One, it sounds like, is more action-oriented almost. When have we seen that recently? Like, give us an example of a demonstration, a mass demonstration even, that was successful in really creating a message and change.
Well, the most important one really over the last, century has been civil rights. Mm. The organizing that was happening in Greensboro, the organizing that was happening in Montgomery, where people were responding to bus boycotts or lunch counter sit-ins, that organizing turned into actions. And it was wildly successful, all of the civil rights legislation that emerged out of that. And then what we started to sort of see within the 90s and early 2000s were these sort of mass protests, right? And I was part of some of these in San Francisco when I lived in the Bay Area. We had about 200,000 people who were opposing the Iraq War, the invasion. Yeah. You get hundreds of thousands of people all over the country. They were powerful. But I think they gave us a false sense that could immediately translate into public policy, into how people think about something. Yeah. And what it actually did was it simply hardened its opposition.
Hmm. I wonder that, because so much of this, and you mentioned social media at the beginning, so much of what's happening right now is on social media, or, there will be someone saying, we're going to all protest this day, and then people show up with various flags and various causes and various things they're angry about. How do you think social media has changed it? Are there ways in which, I always thought, social media would be help to causes like this, because you can socially organize something, you know, like a demonstration. But it seems to have almost just fractured people more.
It has. You know, the various echo chambers people live in and their sort of online worlds. And because it has this sort of vast access, that it can pull in lots of people. But what it lacks is the ability to have them be organized, mm-hmm. right? And what they hope to accomplish in unison.
Yeah.
What we have now is just a whole lot of people bringing their own sort of perspectives to these meetings, saying a bunch of different things. There's little coherence. There's almost no organization. And the worst part is when they leave, no one has a phone number. No one has an address. No one has shook a hand. No one has built a meaningful relationship that will bring them out and get them to do the daily work of organizing.
Limitations.
Absolutely.
Do you think there is still a role for protest like that, or maybe it has to be demonstration at this point?
I think we need healthy levels of both.
Hmm.
But I think we need to vastly increase our demonstrations, which mean we need people to be engaged in organizing in non-crisis moments.
What about the Black Lives Matter protests just, you know, a few years ago in 2020, like where, you know, there was a specific message, but it was a lot of no, but it was also very successful, even if we may be seeing a backlash to some of that now.
Yeah, I mean, it's really one of the greatest protests in human history. You know, people on all continents across age and race and language and religion all evoked the name George Floyd. And in Minneapolis, in George Floyd Square, those activists took that protest and they translated it into an opportunity to demonstrate and to organize and to turn all of that energy into meaningful structural change.
How much are demonstrations about leaders?
Yeah. Demonstrations are definitely about leaders. And here's, you know, I think a useful critique of the left. You know, they have an aversion to leadership. And I think that because we've sort of gotten accustomed to being allergic to leadership and also to a certain degree being allergic to power, it can have negative implications in terms of organizing. And I think, you know, those on the left might want to take lessons from those on the right in looking and saying that, you know, organizing, having clear leadership, you know, not being allergic to power might be useful in terms of how we strategize, build organizations, demonstrate, and engage in the sort of minutia of the democratic reality in terms of state politics or local politics or federal.
Could you look at the election of Donald Trump as a form of protest from the right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a form of protest, right? It is tens of millions of people cohering around an anti, right? And the anti is, you know, wokeness or the left in general or a Black woman in leadership, you know, and it was effective. It was absolutely effective. And what I think the Trump administration is trying to do is also to turn that protest into an organized, coherent form of political organization.
Yeah.
And we're going to see if it's effective. We're going to see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
And this, for me, is the difficult part. And I think both, you know, those on the right and the left struggle with this, but I do think those on the right are doing it better.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Rashad Shabazz, Associate Professor of Geography and African American Studies in ASU Schools of Social Transformation and Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.